Next case is 04-1293, Shirley E. Smith versus Matthew L. Smith. Mr. Philkins.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is John Philkins, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Matthew Smith. I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The operative facts in this case are as follows. The appellant, Matthew Smith, and the appellee, Shirley Smith, developed a relationship back in December of 1986. That relationship lasted only 1 or 2 months, ending in January or February of 1987. After that relationship ended, they never again had any contact whatsoever. Not by letter, not by phone, none whatsoever. Neither party ever saw or contacted the other, and shortly thereafter, the appellant determined that she was pregnant. However, at no time did she ever contact the appellant, nor did she ever advise the appellant that she thought that she was pregnant with his child. The appellee gave birth to Anthony Smith on October 27th of 1987. The appellee never told the appellant that she had given birth to this child. She never told the appellant that she had given birth to the child, nor did she advise them she thought that this child was his. The record will reflect that even though she had given birth to this child and she believed that this child was in fact his, she never attempted to contact him, even though she knew that he continued to reside in the Findlay area where she resided for a period of 2 years. She also testified at the time of hearing that she was aware of the fact that he had moved to the state of Florida. The evidence further reflected that she continued to work at the same place that his family members worked for the next 10 years. The appellee gave no explanation to the court for waiting these 10 years before bringing any action to establish paternity before the juvenile court. And it was the juvenile court magistrate that found that her waiting these 10 years to be unreasonable and for an unexplained length of time. Even though the magistrate found it for an unexplained and unreasonable length of time, the magistrate, the juvenile court magistrate, still found that my client, the appellant in this matter, still owed child support arrearages from date of birth of the child for that 10-year period of $41,833.06. On August 27th of 2002, the appellant filed a motion to set aside or otherwise extinguish the arrearages between the date of birth of the child and the date of the commencement of the action to establish parentage. And that was pursuant to the statute which we are here upon today. That would be section 3111.13 of the Ohio Revised Code.
The trial court here ordered the support before the statute was amended. Is that correct? In other words, she had an order from the trial court saying you are entitled to X number of dollars, $47,000.
That is correct.
Okay. So is not the important legal issue here whether the prospective versus retrospective application of the statute? And you argue that she had a substantive right because she was awarded this custody or this support, and the statute, by purportedly limiting that amount, affects a substantive right. That's your strongest argument, is it not?
Our position, the appellant's position, that it is a remedial application of section 3111.13. The position of the appellee would be that it is an application against her substantive right.
The Appellee's argument, but what is
correct.
What's your strongest argument against it?
Strongest argument is that the application of 3111.13 section F3 as applied is just a remedial measure. Because as applied, going back, and it is retroactive application, it mandates that she, as the mother of the child, must have made a dedicated and sincere effort to find the father, to establish a parent-child relationship. Otherwise, she's not entitled to receive more than the first 3 years' worth of child support for the benefit of the child.
But the statute, as it's applied, does deprive her of a fairly substantial amount of money, doesn't it?
It would limit her recovery to that first 3 years. And I think that's the biggest distinction here, particularly from the standpoint of the decision of the appeals court, because the appeals court specifically limited its decision to finding that it was the taking away of the right, not of the mother, but rather, and it specifically identifies him by name, specifically takes away the right of Anthony's right of support. Specifically identifying that it was Anthony's right which was being taken away from him. And that is the primary basis for the argument in this case, is that the statute is not being applied to Anthony. Anthony is receiving current support, and in addition, one could argue that he's also receiving child support arrearages for those first 3 years following his birth. And the Court of Appeals specifically identified that that's how the statute was unconstitutional. And that was the basis for this appeal, because the statute itself is not applying itself to Anthony, but rather to his mother. Now, in this particular case,
that doesn't really have any effect on whether the statute is remedial or substantive.
It's
the extinguishment of a right.
It's not the complete extinguishment of the right, though. No, not completely. And that's why I make the distinction, because of the fact that in this particular case, it's identifying the distinction of what mother's choice was. Mother had the right, the ability over that 10-year period of time to pursue father. She knew who father was. She knew father's location. She had the ability to pursue him over that period of time. And the legislature identified what her obligations were. Now, admittedly, they made this statute effective after the time period in which that 10-year period of time had already run. Now, obviously, they're imposing upon her an obligation which she had already identified that she had failed in, one that she had not taken upon herself. But again, they are not denying to the child the right of support. The child has, and as Judge Bryant in the dissent identified, the child has not gone without support for that 10-year period of time. The child had support from his mother, and maybe from someone else in addition to his mother, but rather what he's identifying in his dissent is rather the child had that support and in addition has current support. And the only thing that is being identified is, in essence, what mother is a creditor going after a debtor for a 10-year period of time in the past. And therefore, this statute is limiting her ability to pursue that the collection of that entire 10-year period of time to a 3-year period of time.
Now, Mr. Filkins, your best argument is that this retroactive statute under our test in Rubbermaid is substantive if it impairs a vested right, which it may appear if we look at it from her standpoint, or remedial if we look at it from his standpoint. So with our test, because we've got a two-part test, how is it that you can reconcile that? And what is your position with respect to the fact that it really does appear, as Justice Resnick points out, to affect a vested right, but it's remedial as to him?
Because of the fact that we're identifying two different parties, once again.
Well, that's my point. When you look at our test, if you look at your client, we could find a way to construe this to be remedial. If we look at at your opponent's client, we could find a way to say that this is substantive. So I guess what I'm asking you is, can you be persuasive as to which argument you feel should carry?
Certainly. From the standpoint of mother, if mother has the burden, the obligation to go forward, to pursue father, why should she get the landfall, the $41,000 worth of benefit for, in essence, doing nothing? She did nothing for 10 years. She sat on her laurels and admittedly,
well, she
found
did,
by the court.
She did do something for 10 years, didn't she?
Certainly, she supported the child.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But that is something that she did, and the trial court found that she supported the child. But
so how is that a, what do you call it, a landfall or a windfall?
Or a windfall. A
windfall.
Absolutely. It's a windfall.
How's the $41,000 a windfall if she by herself supported the child for those?
Because of the fact that it's calculated later in time and it doesn't take into account that the father was denied any contact with the child whatsoever, and it takes into account a theory of what actually occurred during that period of time. We don't know where the support came from. All we did was we took incomes in theory of what the parties were over that 10-year period of time. And in theory, what we did was we imputed minimum wage to the parties over that period of time, because we couldn't come up with exact incomes for that period of time. But in reality, could they have greater incomes? Could they have lesser incomes? Could she have been living with a third party who had greater income than she, who provided all the support for the child?
Well, that's sort of up to your client, isn't it, to prove all of that, if that's the case? I mean, if all of those nasty things were out there, then it's your client's job to call that the attention of the judge or magistrate, and if it doesn't,
it's kind of difficult.
Luck.
Kind of difficult, but that's a true point to establish. But it's over a 10-year period of time when my client now lives in the state of Florida, still continues to live in the state of Florida. It's somewhat difficult to establish what has occurred during that period of time.
Is your strongest argument that by sitting on her rights, making the choice on her own not to let him know he had a child, she chose to raise that child without his support, but she also deprived him of the ability to establish a relationship? And now she comes in afterwards and says, I want the money, but you didn't have the chance to know you had a child for 10 years. Is that the equity that weighs in this balancing act between the two parties on your side? That seems to be the strongest.
That would be, and that was, again, an argument raised through the idea of latches. And that gets us back to the common law theory that, and one of our strongest arguments is there's no entitlement to child support from date of birth of the child.
Counsel, let me follow up on that.
Sure.
He's now paying current child support.
Absolutely.
And what's the relationship he has with the child now?
Although it's not set forth in the record, I would indicate there exists no relationship with the child, no father-child relationship.
So he doesn't seem to care now.
And I would indicate that the record doesn't speak to that issue, Your Honor. But with regards to the common law...
Well, counsel, isn't the true issue here is the legislature set up this statute. Obviously, the effect is to encourage children or parents of children who are born out of wedlock to get together to recognize the existence of a child and address their obligations. And the obligations is not a one-way street. The mother has obligations, the father has obligations.
Absolutely.
And the father can't exercise his obligation or fulfill his obligation without notice.
I agree.
And going back to the intent of the statute, they have created a net or a scheme or a means by which there is an incentive for the female, who is the only, at date of birth, the only known or without any dispute, the parent of that child. It is incumbent upon the mother to get the ball rolling as far as support goes here.
Absolutely.
So it seems to me that what their relationship is now, what he was deprived of, whatever, throughout the 10 years where he didn't even know this person was in existence, is not the issue. And I think the definition of whether it's substantive or remedial, would you not agree that if her dollar amount, her recovery, this $41,000, if that was totally extinguished, would there be no question, I think, that they had affected a substantive right?
Well, it would not be, if I'm reading the statute correctly, it would not be extinguished, but rather it would be impacted or affected.
But if the statute said there was no recovery possible without notice, et cetera, but here the statute allows for 3 years of recovery.
Correct.
No matter when you notify the parent. But you're
correct.
Limited. They're not extinguishing your right for reimbursement.
Correct. It's my understanding that they would be limiting the right. I see that my time is limited. May I respond?
Finish your answer then.
Yes. It would be my understanding that they are limiting the ability to respond to that time period of the 3 years following the date of birth of the child.
But so, then, once the paternity is established, it's prospective in its application.
Not once the paternity is, it's a technical issue, but not once paternity is established, but rather once the action for paternity is commenced. So you may file your actions January 1st, but paternity is not established.
But by the time it's all sorted out, so you go back to January 1st for prospective child support.
That is correct.
Correct. Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pilkins.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Powell.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I am Steve Powell, and I do represent Mrs. Smith, now known as Jolliffe. If I do refer to her in that fashion, I do apologize. She is remarried now. As indicated by Mr. Filkins, that there are some important facts here, but I think these facts are the real critical ones and may answer some of the questions that were raised by the panel here, and that this case was decided on March 10th, 1999. This appellant never married to my client, was married at the time he had the relationship, broke it off with my client, and all the issues that have been litigated here, the knowledge of the pregnancy, the birth, the no contact, as well as the 10 years between the birth and the paternity actions, those are all issues that have already been litigated. That's the point about this retroactivity argument, as well as the separation of powers. The equitable defense of latches to the paternity proceeding was raised, and it was already found, 1999, that there was no material prejudice and there was no relief of his duty to provide support to his minor child. There was full.
But counsel, that was under the current state of the law in 1999.
Correct.
We're operating with a new set of rules with the legislation that limits the recovery, the reimbursement to your client for the 3 years from birth, 3 years forward, and then the prospective application once the activity or the action is filed.
Right.
So it's whatever was adjudicated and imposed by the juvenile court resulted in an award of, what, $44,000 or $41,000 in arrearages?
Correct.
Which encompassed the 3 years that are now, according to 3111.13F3, available to her still, those 3 years.
If you take her case and now apply it to the new statute, and apply it prospectively, yes.
Okay.
That's exactly what I'm trying to make the point on, is that these issues have already been decided in our court system.
Is your distinction, well, let me ask it this way. If you had a current mother whose child is 15, and she goes back and sues, similar fact pattern and everything like that, she gets a judgment, but it's post the statute. She doesn't have the right anymore to collect beyond those 3 years under the new statute. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Even though under the old law, she would have had that right of support for those first 12 years.
Up to and include the whole time that, that passed.
So what, the only difference I see in that fact pattern and yours is your argument that your decision was reduced to judgment already, whereas this current case would not reduce to judgment. So your distinction in terms of arguing a substantive versus a remedial is really a judgment that your client holds versus an actual right that has been extinguished by the new statute for the mother I'm talking about.
Yes, that's true. But I also want to point out that I have struggled with what if asked this question regarding the prospective application, whether it is unconstitutional. I felt as if I was drifting off into an area I shouldn't now, because I need to focus on the fact that this is already done. I think that somewhere down the line, maybe that issue of prospective application might still come before the court, but I'm dealing with a very specific fact that this has already been done, and through the Court of Appeals, it was done under all appellate rules, under all the civil rules.
But Mr. Powell, the enactment, I think that Justice O'Connor was redirecting your position, is that subsection C talks about a party is entitled to modification of an order regardless of whether the judgment or court order from which the relief is sought was issued prior to the effective date of this amendment. So encompassed in the latest enactment of the General Assembly is the contemplation of your client's situation, where a judgment had already been rendered by a court. And the restriction, I think, as Justice O'Connor was pointing out, is now limited to 3 years.
That's correct.
And I think that's where we are. So the question becomes whether or not that is or isn't retroactive, and whether or not it should be applied.
Correct.
So what is your best argument?
Well, I have a couple of them. First of all, I think I need to address the Court of Appeals dissent in this case, because it's the only, besides the one argument that my opposing counsel makes, is the only arguments I've heard against it. And he, the dissent in that case stated that the issue is not the child's right to be supported, and I disagree with that. This issue is about the child's right to be supported, because it's taking away something that has already been prescribed by the Court of Appeals, and by statute.
You think the child has a right to more past support?
The child has a right to support. The statute
support. We're not talking about future support. We're talking about past.
Yes, there's several arguments with that. First of all, trial court retains jurisdiction regarding those issues, and to issue, and has discretion on how to issue, how much, and when it starts, and so forth. The child support statutes say that both parents have a duty to support that child.
I understand.
Nobody else. Mm-hmm. The mother and the father. It also allows any other person to come in and enforce that right, whether it be CSEA or a grandparent, whoever.
Yep.
Okay.
I think Mr. Filkin's argument is that this is remedial as to the $41,000 arrearage judgment. And because it should be construed, the statute should be construed by us as remedial, we ought to construe it in that fashion and reduce that judgment. I think that's his position.
Sometimes hard for me to figure out, too, because I cannot, in my mind, support that argument.
Why should it not be considered as remedial as to him, as a remedy, because the legislature says we don't think you have to pay 10 years, we only want you to pay 3.
I think the argument was that the trial court retains discretion in any fashion in order to deal with this issue of child support, okay? And that's my point. That discretion is granted to the court, and they deal with it in the form of evidence. In this case, there's no evidence presented here. It's going back, taking something that was already given to the child, recognized as a right for the child, all right, and then—
Well, counsel, is that given to the child or an award to the mother for past support that she carried 100% of the obligation for 10 years, and this is what he would have contributed or been ordered to contribute had he been on the scene for 10 years.
It's a child's right to be supported.
And the dissent, Judge Bryan, argues that the child was supported for those 10 years by the mother. And this is a reimbursement to the mother. It is not such as prospective, to be used for the child.
It's trivializing the child support issue here, likening it to a credit card debt. We do not send people to prison for a credit card debt. We do for criminal non-support of a child. Now, I understand this is not an issue of criminal non-support, but that's how important it is. Another issue that comes to mind is that we do not allow the child support to be discharged through bankruptcy. We do on credit card debts. We also, once the litigation has ended with respect to the property issues like credit card debts, the court is, when it is done, a decision is done, if there's been any appeal, when it's finally done, it's done. You cannot relitigate credit card issues or other property issues. The court reserves the right to come back in here and deal with child support because it's that important. It is not like
so. If there is the ability to modify child support, which you agree, and it's modified statutorily by the General Assembly, where's the problem?
The problem is
because it's retroactive. Is that your problem?
Yeah, that's my argument. It's clear. It is applied retroactively. The issue
becomes... Well, the statute says
yes,
it will apply, you know...
That whole family of statutes under the House and Senate bills were applied that in that fashion. And I believe they're all unconstitutional for that reason with regard to the child support.
Is it just because of the retroactivity of the application? Would you say any statute that has a retroactive application is unconstitutional?
No. Of course not. The analysis requires that we look and see whether or not this is a substantive right. As in Dixon versus Walcott said, you can't think of any other greater right or any other greater obligation for the parent to support this child. All right?
It defies
common sense.
Here, the support, the obligation, is not necessarily the issue, it's just the amount. The right and the obligation are still intact. It's just a limitation on the dollar amount, which is the argument for making it a remedial, corrective statute and its application, as opposed to substantive, which would negate the obligation.
There's been no evidence in this case, it's not part of the record, that there's been anything this child could have received or could have had as a result of being supported by both parents at the time of this 10-year period. Unfortunately for the opposing counsel and his client, this was decided that there was no material prejudice to him. They balanced the best interest of the child with the obligations and so forth and came out on top with the child should be receiving this amount. It's an order that's been in place since 1999. And I can't think of anything that isn't more substantive. We take care of our children. We impose obligations upon the parents.
Now, I don't think that's the definition of what makes something substantive. Is whether we all agree it's important to support children. That's not the issue here on how we determine whether it's substantive or it's remedial.
Well, I think the question is then, does this take away a vested right of, or a vested right already given to this child and to the mother of this child? And how does
it take away the right? It just changes the dollar amount.
Prospectively, it does. We already have a judgment. This child has already been awarded this amount of child support. sometimes it's a tough argument, I know. But when I, well, the bottom line is there's also a separation of powers argument, too. And I don't think that needs to be ignored with regard to the res judicata argument as well as Civil Rule 60. I think it's unconstitutional under both of those portions of the Ohio Constitution. It's common sense. Rule 60B is what allows them to a party to overcome the issues of res judicata, and the rules are specifically set out. The court has the power to set those rules, not the legislature. I also want to point out before I end here today that there is and some uncodified law with regard to House Bill 242 that changed the statute that I think is important. I did not have part of that in my argument in the brief because I just found it. However, it does state in Section 3 that the General Assembly hereby declares that it is a person's or male minor's substantive right to obtain relief from final judgment, court order, and or administrative determination, or order that determines that the person or male minor is the father of the child and requires the person to pay the child support for a child. I think clearly that shows that the legislature knew they had a problem when they were setting forth the this new statute and the provisions in there, in that with regard to retroactivity, they were making sure that they were showing that there was some other substantive right, the father's substantive right, which somehow lessens the impact of the impairment of the child's right to the support. With regard to the separation of powers argument, also, I think the legislature was making sure that we understand that they're not affecting procedure in this case, which is reserved for the court.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Filkins, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to start you with a question. I was somewhat persuaded by the dissent. Until this mother is a creditor here because she chose to not ask for help from the father. She knew who the father was for 10 years. Until Mr. Powell reminded us of Section 3103.03, which permits a third party, someone who has no obligation to support children, to seek reimbursement for, it's a little different here, seek reimbursement for necessities that that third person has provided for the support of the child. What is that? You read his brief. What do you think of that argument?
From the standpoint of someone pursuing necessities?
Well, it seems to me that the General Assembly is saying that someone, even someone who doesn't have an obligation to support the child, can seek reimbursement, which is what the mother is doing here, seeking reimbursement, which would seem to perhaps weaken the argument of the dissenting judge.
If you were to establish, if it was pursued in the same fashion, you'd still have to establish parentage. There'd still have to be notice to father. There would still have to be the same requirement of giving father notice of the fact that someone is pursuing that obligation. And I still think that there'd still be a requirement that reasonable notice be given of the fact that it's being pursued, what it's being pursued for. Whereas a credit card obligation doesn't require an establishment of knowledge of paternity. It can be brought up at any time. A provision of necessities can be brought at any time. Versus the paternity action, which I think has been pointed out, and as the dissent pointed out, there's only one person in this particular case that is in particular position to have knowledge. One person and one person alone, not a third party. Maybe a doctor, but in this case,
but counsel,
it's the mother.
The very crux before you even get started, whether it's a third party, CSEA or CSB or whomever, mm-hmm. the Department of Family Services, etc. The very first step is the establishment of paternity. Whether you're a third party creditor, whether you're the mother, whatever, and that's the obligation here that is placed on someone seeking the support.
Absolutely.
When a mother has a child and then goes to the Department of Human Services for medical expenses, for monthly support, for whatever programs are available, they insist on an identification of the so that they can proceed with paternity.
Absolutely.
And that is the very focal point here and the impetus to get these type of obligations established and then to go forward from there. The
Absolutely.
Sooner, the better. And apparently, the General Assembly thought so.
And I agree. And that, I think, and this was going to be the crux of the rebuttal was to once again point to...
Very quickly, since we've used
absolutely,
your time.
Absolutely. Judge Bryant, to quote Judge Bryant, the mother is the person best in a position to establish the paternity of the child. If she chooses to prevent the establishment of a father-child relationship, she is, in effect, choosing to forego the father's assistance to support the child. She always has the ability to file a paternity action for financial support by the father. By limiting the amount of arrearage that can be calculated to 3 years, the legislature is limiting only the mother's right to reimbursement. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkins. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.